This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
There's one more element to this I want to get to today. It's what she was diagnosed with, and it's another area that there's a lot of misunderstanding about and misinformation about out there, and a lot of uneducated, uninformed conjecture out there about, quite frankly. That's bipolar. Lindsay Clancy was treated for anxiety and depression for 4 months. After her children died, a Columbia psychiatrist evaluated her for 8 hours and diagnosed bipolar disorder with psychosis, according to her lawsuit. Her defense is built on that diagnosis. Most people hear bipolar and they picture the Hollywood cartoon version of it, if you will. Big mood swings, up one day, down the next. And then there are elements to that which might be true, but that's like the simplistic, super surface level of what's going on here. The actual line is a manic episode. Let's help folks understand what that is in plain English, Siobhan.
Yes, please.
Mania has a lot of misunderstanding. People always think it means the happy manic, right? Running through the street naked. Sometimes that happens. I've had when I worked mobile crisis, I would be called out. Joe is running down the street naked. Can you come pick him up? I'm like, I may need some police support to catch Naked Joe here, right?
Naked Joe, there he goes again.
Yeah, that was kind of it.
Yeah. I had my big wheel when I was 6 years old going down the middle of the highway, too. I think I must have been manic.
What? That's a whole other episode, I think, we just found out right there.
Me and my big wheel when I was six, man, we did a lot of crazy shit. Anyway, sorry.
but the thing that people don't understand is that mania can also, man, it's basically the brain is going too fast. And you can also have extreme irritability. And sometimes people commit crimes because they get so angry. They may be in road rage incidents. And that can be from a manic episode. They're not the happy manic. The other thing about it, you can have mixed episodes where people are experiencing the racing thoughts, some delusional thinking. They may be hearing voices, and they may also be depressed and feeling a tremendous amount of, I can't go on. I should just die. There's something terribly wrong with me. And you can have, in a mixed episode, which this looks a lot like a mixed episode to me, you can have both things happening simultaneously. So she has a lot of energy. I can do the 5K. I can clean my garage. I can do activities with the kids. And then having this crash, which looks very much like major depressive disorder. So you have to really consider, particularly if you start an SSRI, you have to really watch, okay, I've diagnosed depression, but if I see insomnia escalating after we have a week on an antidepressant, an SSRI, we really need to look at is this mania? And as I said, the brain is sick. It is not operating normally. It is not regulated. So you can see a lot of changes in the person's normal baseline.
How difficult is it to diagnose bipolar? Her psychiatrist testified that she considered bipolar disorder in December of 22 and ruled it out because Clancy had, quote, never had mania. She described what she was looking for: euphoria, very high energy, grandiosity. And then even when it was somewhat suggested, one of the doctors did testify that they had kind of, you know, put it out there as a bit of a suggestion. The initial reaction, pushback from Patrick, if my wife doesn't have it, well, I don't fucking care what you think. This is a doctor. Yeah. You're not. And I don't care what Lindsay thinks either. She's a doctor. You're not. If someone's observing this, it matters. And there's meaning behind it. But I guess, why did they not get there? Were there not enough questions being asked? Because they're certainly, I mean, running the marathon at 2 weeks after giving birth seems kind of like a big red flag.
It's a red flag.
I mean, so what, walk me through that. When you suspect that someone might have it, is this something where you got to observe for a longer period of time to really get there? And what kind of, I mean, reality is this, I'm not surprised, and I'm not trying to denigrate Patrick for saying my wife doesn't have that. I'm sure that's probably the common reaction from a lot of people and their partners of that's not what they have. But what is it like being the doctor in there when you're suspecting this might be what that is, from suspecting to actually saying and getting there as this is the official diagnosis, and then having the family and the patient understand, here's what you got going on, and this is how it needs to be treated.
Yeah, it's unfortunately difficult for many providers to diagnose. I happen to have a lot of experience with it for a variety of reasons. Mm-hmm. And it does not present necessarily really florid in the beginning, where you've got the rapid speech and people are talking and coming up with grandiose ideas. It can present more subtly. And this is where spending a lot of time getting to know the person and talking to the family. The red flags for me, if I were listening to Lindsay, the sleep, the getting worse after an SSRI, red flag, 48 hours with zero sleep, no sleep and not feeling particularly tired the next day, racing thoughts, because that's a classic kind of bipolar. The thoughts go so fast, they can't keep up with them. Mm-hmm. Feeling desperate. And there were a few more things I heard that I thought, the desperation of, I just can't go on. Mm-hmm. I'm afraid I might hurt the children. I'm having bad thoughts, or I'm having horrible thoughts, I think she said. This sounds delusional. Mm-hmm. And that's more than what she was being diagnosed with.
Yeah.
And I would think it should have been picked up on much sooner.
You know, I think that's such a key point. You brought about so many good points that they should have picked up on, Siobhan, because as we're talking about the manic mania part of it and running a 5K a couple weeks after she gave birth and everything, when you look at the arc of her life, I can understand why Patrick would say she's not manic, because she always, I think people mistake tempo.
She's motivated.
She's got a high tempo. You know why I recognize it? Because like when we're describing her, it's like friggin', I've never been pregnant, but that's the stupid shit I do. I mean, I have this high tempo in life. And so that will present to someone, whether you're, pre-manic and post-manic, like the outward presentation of energy is going to look the same. But those answers, those questions you brought up, Siobhan, those are what are different, because that's where. And so the follow-up question to that is, you've been doing this I won't say a very long time, because
it's a
you're
very long time.
I know, but I didn't want to age you. But how long did it take you to be able to recognize? Because what happens? Every rep you get, like say a manic presentation is a wobble, right? And when you first start doing these things, that wobble you have to see, because you don't have experience, it has to be like this. Deviation. How long did it take before you could actually see it like this? You know, what these people missed, like you saw wobbles here that others weren't. How long does that take to get that they didn't have?
I would say the first week when she reported the Zoloft really impacting her sleep, because we know an SSRI, if somebody has a predisposition to bipolar, you really have to watch giving them an SSRI. You really have to watch that. And if you see an escalation of symptoms, more racing thoughts, the lack of sleep, at that point, a doctor needed to be thinking about, is there a differential diagnosis possibly with a bipolar spectrum disorder going on here? And the other thing is, her high level of functioning for many years, could have been early bipolar, but we would call it bipolar 2, which means it's not as severe and the person is not having delusions and hallucinations. And it could be that with the pregnancy, the stress, the hormone levels. I mean, I have seen people go bipolar who had no previous symptoms, but have a horrendous bipolar episode in boot camp, which is very stressful. And that can happen. Yes, you'll see a lot of that.
Yeah.
Oh my God, explain. You just had my eyes, Joe. So I was coming to commander of Marine Corps boot camp at Parris Island. And yeah, we had a lot of amazing mental health issues going on down
I'll
there.
I'll bet. So. Yeah, because people are kept up, they lose sleep, and the stress is incredibly high because, of course, you want to make sure that in a battle zone that they're not going to, you know, have a bipolar episode.
Keep functioning, right.
Yeah, but it really happens in boot camp a lot.
I mean, how often is it that people go for good chunks of their life being bipolar or in bipolar 2, or I don't know if there's a stage leading up to that too, but where they go for a long ways in that realm and function maybe in very incredible ways, because I can see how it can almost be a superpower in some ways. Yes. Until they can't, basically, until something happens, an event happens that makes it, okay, this is no longer a superpower. This is becoming a detriment. How common is this where it goes on for that long until it can't? And it's not like, you know, maybe they're well into life.
Yeah. Yeah, I think many people go their entire lives and are never diagnosed. And these are the people that are often, we reward hypomania. The person that's super productive, they don't take days off. They're working all the time. They work late. They work on holidays. And it's like, look what they're doing. And that can be hypomania. They may have episodes of depression, but they don't get delusional and the hallucinations that really put them into the bipolar 1 category, which is the more severe.
Is that a difficult one to diagnose? Because it can also present as other things as well. Like what differentiates that from other personality disorders or other things of that nature that could be affecting in those sort of ways?
Yeah, those are the ones you really have to observe over time and look for patterns. And it's like, if I hear of somebody working 12, 14-hour days, 7 days a week, working through holidays, they may be a therapist, right? But
or me.
Or Tony. I thought of you. Yeah, I thought of you.
Asking for a friend.
Yeah. But when it's...
You all have no idea how much he does. No shit.
I believe it.
He's a nutter.
Yeah. But when you see it impairing their lives, when it's impacting them in negative ways, I think clinicians need to look closer for possible bipolar disorder. I do think it's missed.
That's why we have Siobhan on staff.
Exactly. Got a question? Think something might be wrong? Call Siobhan. It's fascinating, and it's one that is clearly, not super well understood. And I get, I don't expect the general public to very well understand these things. It's not, especially if you're not seeing them on a daily basis. To close it out, Siobhan, you've been watching this trial. I mean, you've been emailing back and forth, and we, we both are like, oh my God, wanting to wring some necks as we're watching this.
And check out her Substack too. Yeah. She's got lots of info she's been putting on that, by the way.
Yes, and that link is on our Substack. What do you want people to walk away with here understanding about the Lindsay Clancy trial at the end of the day, regardless of what 18 people decide about her fate?
I think people need to understand what they don't know and be open to new information. Because if you just listen to the testimony, throughout the whole thing, we haven't even heard the defense witnesses yet. Mm-hmm. But you can learn a lot and use your thinking brain. Don't go into your amygdala where it's just about, I want to punish. Be open to new information. analyze it. You can do a lot of reading online about bipolar disorder and get out of this conspiracy mentality of just needing to blame. People like conspiracies. It makes them feel important, right? It's like, we've got the information here. And then they pump each other up on the internet. They're doing harm. They're really doing harm. And we want the jury to be analytical, thinking, thoughtful, looking at the evidence. And really, all our lives are going to be better when we do that.
Yeah, without
Stay
a doubt.
Curious.
Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. Love for you to weigh in and give them to us right there. Siobhan's books, Nightbird. This is her memoir. I highly recommend checking it out wherever you get books or audiobooks. Also, The Minds of Mass Killers, also available wherever you get books. Go and check those out. Robin's latest, It's Not All About Me. It is available wherever you get books as well and audiobooks. Leave a review on Amazon. All right. Until next time, for Siobhan, for Todd, for Robin, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
And now we're going to have a conversation about Patrick, Clancy, because so many folks have discovered or thought that he's a really interesting person to drag down into the depths of hell and stomp on a few thousand times. While Lindsay Clancy's trial plays out in Plymouth Superior Court, a parallel trial is happening on TikTok. Creators are accusing Patrick Clancy of murdering his own children and pushing Lindsay out of the window. Based on nothing. The defense admitted in an open court that Lindsay did all of this. She's admitted it. The question is what, if anything, the man who lost three children can do about the people calling him a killer on the internet. This one's for you, Patrick. So we have Eric Faddis here with us, former prosecutor, defense attorney, and Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. We've seen it. TikTok creators, YouTubers posting videos accusing Patrick Clancy of killing his own children. They're calling him the next Chris Watts. They're claiming Lindsay didn't jump. He pushed her. His wife's own defense team already told the jury she did it. Is that defamation or is it something else, Eric? And what sort of paths does Patrick Clancy have to the creators? And I put that in air quotes for those of you listening on the podcast, who seem to think that this is a great road to go down and inflame a bunch of people's lack of other things to do around.
Yeah, you know, certainly if someone is making a factual statement about Patrick Clancy that he murdered his children, and that statement is false, that could be grounds for Patrick Clancy to bring a defamation case against that person. One potential issue that comes up, though, is in order to prevail, Patrick Clancy would have to prove that that statement is false, that he did not do this. Now, proving a negative can be a lot harder than you think. That's one reason why our judicial system is set up the way it is. The defense does not have to prove that they didn't do it, because proving you didn't do something is a lot harder. We're talking about the absence of evidence. We're talking about circumstantial stuff and inferences and things like that. And so for Patrick Clancy to prevail on it, you know, to prove, hey, I for sure didn't do this, that might be difficult.
Is that difficult, though, given that she said I did do it?
Isn't that difficult? There's timestamps. There's everything that shows he was not the one who
did it. Besides that, she said, I did it. So yeah. Does that prove?
You know, I think, is it absolute proof that someone else says they did something of which you're being accused? It's not absolute proof. now, certainly, I think that this one would be easier to prove that he didn't do it than other cases. But, you know, I think that the commentator would say, hey, this is how I feel about it. And I think this guy looked shady on the stand. I think he's been, you know, holding back, or however they want to characterize it. And that's the basis for my opinion. And I just think it gets a little messy trying to prove a negative.
I guess what the problem that we have here today is the fact that so many people have access to a microphone and a camera, and people who want to go down whatever dark road they want to visit, whether it's factually based or not. With that being said, a lot of people don't have an understanding of law, of defamation, of libel, of slander. They just think that if they go out there and say, well, that's my opinion, that completely covers them. Does that really cover somebody, Eric? I mean, help people understand the ground rules a little bit more about what you can and can't get away with legally. I mean, I think some people are hedging their bets. It's like, is Patrick Clancy going to spend the time and the effort and the money suing, you know, Susie and Paducah, you know, who has $30 to her name for saying some crazy shit online and inflaming tens of thousands of people? Is that worth it? Does it go anywhere other than a huge slap on Susie's wrist? There's that of, would he actually go after Susie? But let's say Susie, you know, has a couple $1 million home and is doing this and has assets and is inflaming a bunch of people. That may be someone that is worth going after to shut the fuck up. Give us some idea here on what the legal ground rules really are for people spewing their shit versus what typically is something that is collectible, if you will, because we're talking, these should be civil accusations.
Right. Yeah. So there are a number of legal issues that come up with that. So if a person makes a false statement about another person and that statement is public and it results in damages to that other individual may likely have a defamation claim against the declarant. Now it has to be a statement of fact and not a statement of an opinion. Well, the difference between those, sometimes it's not terribly clear. You know, if I say, the sky is blue, but that's just my opinion. That's, you know, whatever. Well, you're stating a fact, and you're trying to sort of have this disclaimer that it's an opinion when it's not. And then on the collectability piece, on the civil side of things, it only makes sense to bring a claim typically if you're able to get something out of it, often monetarily. And if a person has assets, even when they have assets, it can be very difficult to force that person to liquidate assets. You got to sell your home because there's this defamation judgment against you. Judges aren't always inclined to do that. Sometimes they'll say, instead, I'm going to give a wage garnishment here, and this declarant's going to owe Patrick Clancy, you know, $20 a month or something for forever. That's not always worth it.
You know, Eric, given this time period we're in where there's all these, every time a big case like this comes up, you always have the conspiracy theorists that go on social media and then it starts spinning up like this. Do a defense attorneys like you and in this case in particular, Kevin Reddington, kind of have a heads up that, hey, stand by, and he kind of preps the people in their lives around them ahead of time saying, listen, there's going to be some shit coming down on you. I mean, can they kind of project that out at all and prep them for that ahead of time? Is that going on, or is it kind of just hold tight and see what happens?
Oh, no. I think it's part of your duty as a counselor to advise on how your life might change because of this legal situation. And so I think it would be very important for the attorney to forecast the challenges and the attacks and all the chaos, everything under the sun that might be coming their way as a result of this.
What advice would you have given Patrick ahead of trial in this case if it was you in Reddington's spot, do you think? Not to put you on the spot, I'm just kind of curious.
Yeah, I think Patrick, from what I saw, did a great job. He was his emotionality was appropriate. He didn't seem to have an axe to grind either way, even though his three children were taken from him. I thought that he handled all of that very well in terms of his demeanor, in terms of him being forthcoming. And I would advise him. I would have advised him that, hey, your life, I know it's already a tremendous bummer, like the biggest, worst thing that could happen. But it's going to get a little worse here for a little bit. And you're going to have to kind of batten down the hatches and endure, unfortunately.
Right. I didn't see the conspiracy on this coming. I'm honestly genuinely surprised. When I first heard about this a couple days ago, I was like, what? Like, there's a conspiracy theory about Patrick Clancy? Like, no way. Like, this has got to be some sort of fringe shit. And then I'm like, oh my God, there's a lot of people that really believe this. I was very just kind of, I don't know. I'm not shocked by a lot, but I was kind of shocked by that. There's a lot I think, oh, there's room for conspiracy. This one I was like,
the vitriol on it and the depth that people are going down and seeing patterns where they don't exist is always interesting to me. But you know why? I said it on the first day too, and I think this is also why people are doing it more now, because she's very compelling to watch visually. And he's incongruent with her behavior. And I think because of that incongruence, like, he didn't collapse on the witness stand like you're seeing her collapse in her chair. And I think when people see, they wanted to see, whether it's in the forefront of your mind or not, they wanted to see some sort of collapse of him emotionally, like you're seeing her collapse, so you can see congruency. Now, he said all the right things. I think he was all in on her. I think he did his due diligence the best he could. You know, like you said, they knew something was wrong with her, and he was doing all he could to support the family, provide for them. I mean, I thought, like Eric said, I think he did a very good job. But I think because you have a visual incongruence between what you're seeing, that's what allows people to say, how come he's so different on this?
What's interesting about that is the same group who would say, let's say Patrick did go in overly emotional, unable to control himself on the stand. They'd be saying, I don't know what they'd be saying, because they're already saying that Lindsay's very authentic reactions are fake. They're already saying she's acting. I don't know what he could have done. I mean, that would have convinced them otherwise. It's like, it's you just can't. You can't win when somebody's already dug in that deep. And going after somebody like this civilly, it's obviously you got to make the prove that it's the accusation here is false that somebody's making. So let's say they can meet that bar. I don't think that would be that hard of one to meet, but let's just say he could get there pretty easily. Beyond that, you got to show some sort of damages, not just you hurt my feelings. If Patrick was denied a job because somebody says, gets out, no, I believe you did this, or something. He'd have to show something, would he not? Some sort of damages to him, something that would have of somehow negatively impacted his ability to make money. What's the bar here, Eric? Because he is a bit of a public figure now. What is the bar here to prove damages in a civil case against somebody who is out there actively spewing this sort of shit?
Sure. So damages is just like a fancy legal word for losses. Mm-hmm. So what is a person's losses? Patrick would have to prove some kind of losses. Like you said, for example, if he was denied a job, then he's being denied that income, allegedly based on some false statements. If someone came and damaged his home or something, that would be a loss. And then also reputational damage. If he's receiving death threats, if people are, shouting at him at the grocery store and stuff, that's something. But really, in damages, you want to hang your hat on a monetary piece if you can. And sometimes that's not so easy in the defamation context.
If you, if Patrick Clancy were coming to you saying, I don't know what the hell to do here. I mean, I just want peace. I want this to wrap up. I'm not trying to put words in his mouth, but I'm guessing he can't wait for this to be over so he can try and find some solace and peace with his life and move forward. But let's say I don't know what to do here. This could be damaging to me. This might follow me around, these insane accusations that people are making about me. What do I do, Eric Faddis, defense attorney?
If it were me, I really thought Patrick was sincere and credible on the stand in terms of how he presents. He seemed wilted by sorrow to me in a very genuine statement. Way, not in a way that he's making it up. And so if I was counseling him, I would say, hey, I think you should put out a video. There's a bunch of people are going to watch it. There's already all of this attention towards you. Put out a video just saying, hey, like, guys, my three children are dead. My life is in shambles. I'm asking you to please not attack me or something. And if you do, you know, we do, I've got to make sure that this doesn't further screw up my life. And in doing so, that means I got to protect myself legally. And so, you know, I just want everyone to be aware that if someone's spreading false stuff about me, there might be a consequence to that. That being said, let's just all like move forward with our lives as best we can. I would probably advise them to do a video like that, but it has an emotional resonance and there's also a bit of a legal threat in there, and then go from there.
Like, hey, Eric, I wanted to ask you a question about the conspiracy theorists, because they're all pointing to this evidence or the lack of evidence there, or the timeline being off, or but this and that and shoes and all this kind of stuff. I think we can all agree that Reddington seems like he's got his shit in line. This guy knows his side of the case. If he saw any of that, Lindsay came to him and said, hey, I did this, but he's seeing all these incongruencies that these theorists are saying they see. Would he still go this direction with the defense, or do you think he tried to defend her as not doing it?
I think that if he could make a colorable presentation that someone other than his client committed these murders, I think he would be duty bound to explore that and probably to at least present that as an alternative to the jury. We have seen no such thing. And I think Reddington is savvy enough to where if there was evidence that someone else besides his client did this, he would present that evidence. That hasn't happened.
I'd also imagine too, and Todd, you bring up a great point. So here's a guy, Reddington, 75 years old, highly decorated attorney, did a lot of research on him. Everyone has. I mean, he's one of the notables, and you can tell by his courtroom presentation, his cross. I mean, he is just an amazing individual. Does anyone really think you can get one by on him? I mean, he is so attuned to wobbles in families, dynamics, because that's what this keeps coming down to. There are so many strong relationships between everyone. So let's put on our conspiracy hat for a second, you know, and go down the road of Patrick doing this. Do you really think that if he wanted to get out of this relationship, to move on with another woman, and by the best way to do that is to kill my three kids and push my wife out the window and move on with my life, that if it reached that point in his life, that there would, and think about all the other cases we've ever covered, every single one, research it yourself, there would be leakage. There would be nurses, there'd be psychiatrists, as bad as they are, there'd be medical people, there'd be law enforcement. All these individuals that interviewed Patrick, Lindsay, and everyone in their circles would say, you know, I don't know about that Patrick guy. You'd be able to pick up on socials, you'd be able to pick it up in text messages that they're just going through in prosecution day. Do you really think that someone would plan all these things and have zero behavioral tells throughout his entire life and relationship with Lindsay? Incongruent. No way.
I would put him in being a state of psychosis, honestly, if he did it.
Yeah, you'd have to.
It's like you'd have to be. I mean, like, it doesn't make any sense. It'd be like the worst planned murder out of a relationship in history. It's like the most barbaric, violent, you're going to get caught. And then somehow think you're going to get away. I mean, but the argument, I guess, on the conspiracy thing is, see, he is getting away with it. That's how good he was.
So he's been planning it his entire life. So what you actually then have is a double psychotic break. No, that's probable.
Yeah, the world's a fun place. That's going to wrap up our conversation for today. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd absolutely love for you to weigh in and give us your thoughts on where this case is going. As always, Eric Faddis, defense attorney, as always, thank you so much for coming on and giving us your insight. Always a fascinating conversation. And Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent. His latest book, It's Not All About Me, available wherever you get books, and also audiobook, and leave it a review on Amazon. Go check that out. All right. Until next time, for Eric, for Robin, for Todd, I'm Tony. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.